Hey guys, this is Suresh Sambandham, founder and CEO of KissFlow. I'm also one of the founders of SaaSBoomi. So as you know, we already had the first season of SaaSBoomi, a super duper success. Now we are into the second season of SaaSBoomi podcast. In the second season, I dive deep into the stories of some of the most impactful startups. As a fellow entrepreneur myself, what I've done is I've attempted to bring perspective of a founder in my conversations with some of the India's biggest SaaS leaders. True to the spirit of SaaSBoomi's for founders and by founders motto, I hope the listeners go home with actionable takeaways in every single episode. So, without further ado, let's get started. Hello, everyone. Welcome to yet another episode of SaaSBoomi podcast. This is season two. I'm Suresh Sambandham, CEO of KissFlow, and I have with me Vetri Vellore from Alay.io, a company that got recently acquired by Microsoft. And I'm actually looking forward to this session. It's been a little tough to catch Vetri, but finally we got him. So Vetri, welcome to the show. And it's been some raving reviews for the show for the I think we are doing the sixth episode or something like that, if I'm right. And so it's a pleasure hosting you. And it will be good if you can take 2 minutes and talk about your own personal background, 2-3 minutes, and then also a little bit talk about the company background of Alay. And then I have some specific questions and follow up from there.
Fantastic. Thanks, Suresh. Thanks really for the opportunity. It took us a while to get connected, but I'm so glad to be here. Excited to have this chat with you today. SaaSBoomi has done amazing things for the ecosystem in Chennai. And my own company, Alay, was a huge beneficiary of that. And I'm looking forward to contributing, hopefully, at least a few things back. About my background, Suresh, I grew up in Chennai. I went to College of Engineering in Guindy, and I came to the States. My intent was to do a PhD, but sometime during the journey, I had applied to Microsoft. And actually, I think I applied for an internship, but I ended up getting a full-time job. So I left with a master's and I joined Microsoft. This was very, very early, even before Windows 95 and all. This was when Microsoft had DOS, right? And I had a phenomenal time working at the company. I ran kind of a couple of large, started on the development side. Then I moved over to running products. And I ran a couple of large product teams for Microsoft. One is actually a business that's now called System Center. It's a multi-billion dollar business now. Back then, it was a few hundred million. And I ran that business. And then I ran Visual Studio Platform team, which is one of the four core pillars of the company and the platform ecosystem as well. But I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I don't know, I had this itch. In fact, when I interviewed with Microsoft, I remember telling the interviewer that I was going to learn the ropes in 5 years and go do something on my own. So I became 14. Because I really had a phenomenal time at Microsoft. I had amazing opportunities and great mentors. I had a phenomenal time. I lost track of what I really wanted to do. And so I left exactly 14 years on the same day I joined the company 14 years later. And I started my first company. It's called Cronus. It was also based out of Chennai and Seattle. And for about myself, right, I don't pursue businesses that are kind of trendy or hot. I don't triangulate saying it was crypto, AR, VR, metaverse, whatever. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? Following trends is a great thing. But my ethos has been about how I work on problems I genuinely care about. Cronus was about how do you have an enterprise mentoring platform? And the reason I pursued that is I had a particularly strong stint at Microsoft. And I don't think it was because I was the hardest working person or the smartest person in the company. And I think it was because I had great mentors who gave me amazing guidance. They didn't give me jobs or anything, but their guidance helped me figure out things and realize more opportunities and have a great time. And I want to bring that power of that learning, mentoring to everyone. So Cronus actually was a bootstrap company. I didn't raise money because I have this other principle that I raise money only when I understand the business really, really well. And in the case of Cronus, by the time I felt like we understood the business, we had a lot of high-value contracts. We had customers like GE, Coke, Amazon, and so on. And so we felt like we didn't have to raise money. And Cronus got acquired. It was not a planned exit. I will tell you about it because the company was doing very well. But we started getting a lot of unsolicited offers. And there are a few other factors why we ended up actually selling the company to a private equity firm. And after that, I started Ally, which is actually a continuation of my journey from Cronus days. And I'll talk about it a little bit more. So this intro is not too long. I'll keep it cut it short. And Ally, as you know, got acquired by Microsoft about 3-4 months back. And now I'm at Microsoft. The mission of Ally is still the same, and I'm still working on Ally, just that now it's part of Microsoft, and we have this amazing market power to take Ally to 100,000 times bigger than it could have been.
Awesome. Yeah. Meaning I actually somehow missed the Cronus story. What was the core idea behind the Cronus product?
See, if you look at how people really learn, so there's people like us, right, who have managed people, managed teams, companies, know this intuitively. But sometimes I'm surprised it's not that obvious, right? How people learn, if you look at the spectrum, right? There's a lot of formal education. And even at work, you send people to seminars or classes and training and so on. But what experts say is really 10-20% of learning at most happens through that. Most of the learning, 60-70%, happens on the job. You have to learn, just-in-time learning, specific concept. And mentoring is a core part of what I call as this experiential learning, right? And one of the most effective parts. And as I was telling you, my own experience, right, during my first stint at Microsoft was enhanced by that mentors. I had very early on people like Dave Thompson. Later on, even Satya was my mentor. He was not the CEO, of course, at the time. He was my mentor. And these folks made a very big difference in how I think about problems and various things. And that is really what Cronus tried to do, but as a mentoring platform. It was a B2B SaaS platform, and users can come in and actually we'll import their profile. And we had eHarmony like features to help them find the right mentors. Once you connect with a mentor, how do you get the best out of it? And then the feedback loop back to the enterprise on how this program is working, what is the ROI of the program, how it's improving employee engagement, retention, and so on. So business also understand this is not just a nice to do, but this is creating business value for them.
Okay, got it. But actually, before I go a little bit into the business side of it, I have one personal question. And the question is related to your last name, because you hail from the same, state I am from. So here, most of us use our father name as like a last name, right? But yours is a little unique. You have the city name like Vellore. Is it Vellore city name or how
do you it is. It is, Suresh. So actually, I shortened my name because my full name is V.T. Vetrivelkumaran. That's how I used to write my name in India. Right. And V is the place where my family is from, Vellore. And T, the initial, was from my father's name, Thirumalai. And then my given name is Vetrivelkumaran. Right. And when I applied to the States to come to grad school here, they asked me in the form, first name and last name. Honestly, I didn't know any better. I was stupid. I said, okay, first name maybe is what I write first. I said, then Vellore is my first name. Then I said, last name must be what it shows up last name. And in the US, as you know, last name is actually a family name, right? So it got messed up because I didn't know better at the time, back in 1990, 91, right? Way back. And now what has happened is people started calling me Vellore because they think that's my first name. And D is my middle initial now, right? So I had to change the way the name and shorten it a little bit to make it easy for people to call me by my right name, which is Vetri. That's what I go by. Vellore is where my family is from, but my family moved to Chennai way, way back, man. I think even my grandmother was born and brought up in Chennai. So I've not been to Vellore a lot, but that's where my family is from.
Okay, interesting. Coincidentally, we are actually doing a event called Idea Patarai in Vellore on February 5th, actually.
it's amazing. Right. I often get emails from people asking the same thing. Even though I really didn't grow up there, I've not even been there often. I just feel this connection. My father decided to keep that in his name. His name was V.J. Thirumalai. And my grandfather had it in his name and so on. So my kids hopefully will have it in their names.
Yeah. It happens. Tech side, right? Like Visual Studio and, System Center and stuff like that. From there, typically when people go on that track, they somehow lose the sense of customer. They become more engineering and less of product. And then also don't have a marketing mindset, marketing or positioning, understanding value propositions, you know, coming up with what could be the price points, understanding competitive landscape, or have the confidence to take a sales call and convince a customer during early days. All of that is completely a different set of skill set, which I don't see people in the hardcore engineering background, you know, have. So what's your comment on this, and how do you, if this is accurate understanding, or did you become that? It would be interesting to understand that.
Got it. No, it's a great question, Suresh. I mean, you're right. I did pretty hardcore engineering work. Right? Very early on, in fact, when I started at Microsoft, I used to work on the transport layer of the operating system. I was one of the people involved in re-architecting what was called MSN back then, from X25 networks to IP networks and so on, right? It was very hardcore because my master's was in distributed systems and I enjoyed that kind of work. But what happened was I was happy just focused on building products. And one of my products actually was an engineering success. It actually won best product awards and amazing stuff. But it was a commercial failure. It sold like 5,000 units in the first year or something, which Microsoft scale is a failure. And that's when I realized that the bigger inflection point, you can have a bigger influence when you are actually at the right intersection of product and technology. And I'm still a technologist at heart, but I'm also a product person. And what does it mean now to be a product person? At the end of the day, to be a product person, you have to deeply understand what customers want. Right. You got to have an insight that nobody else has. If everyone knows the same thing, then the first person to build it wins, right? But if you have an uncommon insight, it gives you a longer advantage. And eventually, if you should catch up, it gives you a longer advantage. I think those things that just drove me to be, how do we make a successful product, kind of pushed me in the direction of how do we understand these insights? How do we work with customers better? So I had to build those skills, right? And even in spite of all of that, I still went and did an MBA here in Seattle at the University of Washington, because I felt like at Microsoft has such an amazing market power to build a business from ground up without that brand. I thought it was a different game plan. You need a different game plan. And that is what I did. I mean, doing the MBA gave me more of a confidence. That's the second thing. The third thing I would say is, I mean, at the end of the day, we are always influencing people. I don't want to call it selling. We are influencing. You're influencing a team to follow a direction. You're influencing your executives to give you resources, even when I was at Microsoft. I think if you are authentic about why you're doing it, people will follow, right? Whether it's executives, customers, or employees, people will follow if your intent is clear and you're being authentic.
Okay, that was great. You know, I'm glad I asked that question. So, meaning two questions in one. One is, how did you coin the name Ale for the company name? Is there a story behind it? Second, why OKR app and what is the trigger? Because one of the surprises I have is, like, for example, if you take me, right, I actually started my career with HP. I started working on rule engines. So I first built the Vodafone fraud detection system using, you know, real-time inference engines in 96-97 timeframe, right? And then the next 3 years I worked on rule engine. And then from there I worked for Selectica, which again was a rule engine company, which is a Silicon Valley-based company. I worked there for 4 years. And then I started Orangescape, now Kissflow, which is at the core is actually a rule engine because that's the space I understand. And then I was trying to take the rule engine to, like, democratize that, right? There is a continuity in the journey. But in your case, right, you are the system center guy. You know, I understand system center because I started my career with writing assembly code and C++ and interrupts, Microsoft DOS interrupts, and write antivirus and stuff like that, right? So from that kind of a systems background, going and building Mentor Connect platform or OKR application is completely different, right? So I would love to understand, how do you get conviction around these problem spaces? Because for me, the conviction around building Kissflow was very straightforward because I've been working on rule engine space and then trying to take it and make it everybody can use it is something that is intuitive, right? Because I've worked in that space for quite some time. But how do you get this kind of conviction and what is the trigger?
Got it. I think there's one common thread throughout all of this, Suresh, in my case, right? I've always been a person who cared about what we are trying to get done and what's the impact of that work, right? I always thought technology is second to the mission, right? what I never looked at it and said, you know what, I'm good at this kind of technology platforms and let me do this. In fact, I used to run the Visual Studio platform team. And when we left and started my first company, I picked Ruby on Rails. I did not do it on C# or .NET because I always thought technology is secondary, right? Customers and how do you have an impact and create a business, create value for them and then create a business has always been the number one factor. And technology is number two throughout. And in fact, I would go one step further, right? I always looked at this as starting the end first. What is the end goal? That's why I'm doing OKR as an ally today. What is the end goal? And then how do we actually focus on the end goal and work backwards from there and make the appropriate choices to reach the end goal? And the end goal for me has always been a mission-driven thing. Problems I deeply care about that I think will have a big impact, in my opinion, on people's lives. So that kind of starting with kind of mission I care about, which is specifically around how do we unlock the potential that's inside all of us. That's why I did mentoring. That's why I'm doing Ally, right? And all of us have amazing potential inside us, right? We need sometimes the right person to unlock it. Sometimes we need the right tools to unlock it. So we can dream big and go after those. That's my passion in life, right? That's what I like to do. As a manager, I try to do it. And now through my products, I'm trying to do that. That's my passion. Then it comes down to, okay, if that's the passion, what are the businesses and products I want to build? And that's where Kronos and Ally came. And then technology was kind of the third choice. So I didn't go about it like based on the technology domains I'm familiar with, but I went in this other order. Another question, Suresh, was around Ally. But before I keep rambling on, did that part I just said make sense? Do you want me to double click?
No, actually, I understand that portion, but I was specifically looking at, meaning coming up with an OKR as an app, as a product idea, right? Has to have some trigger, right? Something should have triggered, hey, you know what? OKR is going to be such an important thing, right? And hence, I'm going to bet on it. Because see, these startup convictions are like, easily 10, 15 year old journeys, right?
Yep.
And you cannot just change them just like that, right?
Yeah.
And hence, it needs to be like a deeper conviction. So that's why I'm trying to understand.
Got it. Fair enough, Suresh. See, my deeper conviction is actually helping to unlock human potential. To be honest, it's not about OKRs. And I'll tell you about Ally in a moment. So that makes sense. And that's the point I was making earlier, right? My conviction is not around OKRs. OKR is a great framework. I've used it and I love it. But in general, I'm not a very ideological person. I mean, there are multiple ways to get to an outcome. The outcome matters more than, oh, it has to be only through this way, right? That shows up in the technology choices I made and so on. But what I would say is Ally, and I'll also tell you why the name Ally was chosen, really is not about OKRs, right? Ally is about how do you bring purpose and focus to work? And then unleash this huge productivity improvement through that. We make people feel great, make organizations accelerate. I mean, think about it, right? Most people who come to work today, they have no idea why they are doing what they're doing. They do something because their manager said, please work on this, or worse, some task management system, Jira said, this is the next epic for you, or next task for you. How do you help everyone understand that they're part of something bigger? It's not like they're coming in every day and laying one brick at a time, but they're building the Taj Mahal, right? How do you help people understand that they are part of something bigger and feel connected to the mission of the company? So if we can bring that purpose to work, right? Most people have no idea. They do something because they were asked to do. You can bring purpose to work. Then if you can actually help people stay focused on the purpose, not the daily whirlwind, not the follow-up from the meeting they just walked out of, which may not even be important, right? But really the 2-3 things that matter in terms of how they contribute to the company or team success, magic happens. We've all seen this, right? People are in the flow. They understand why their work matters. They feel engaged. They feel happy. And they're focused. So they're producing more in the right direction. And that is really what Ally is trying to do. How do we bring purpose, focus, and happiness to work and unleash the productivity gains from that? Some of our customers, in fact, talk about 2 times to 4 times increase in productivity. Like these are not, again, usually productivity tools talk about 10% increase or 20% increase, but 2 times, 4 times, right? And again, this we have all seen this as managers, but it's hard to scale, hard to replicate. And that is really what Ally tries to do. And OKR is a framework that we use to actually get to that outcome of how do we bring purpose, happiness, and productivity to work. And OKR is a framework I used when I was doing Kronos. When Kronos was small, I was like, how do we actually run company in a more modern way? What is a modern operating system for running a company? And I checked out two or three other models as well. There's something called Rhythms. There are a few other models. And OKR personally resonated with me because a lot of the values in OKR resonated with my own value system, like transparency, being data-driven, not ego or personality-driven, and so on. And I adopted it at Cronus and then very quickly realized it was hard to use it without a proper tool. I tried to do it with spreadsheets and PowerPoint. Didn't quite work well because what you're driving with OKRs is a cultural change, right? Transparency, setting ambitious goals and all that stuff, focusing more on learning, not just on the outcome and so on. And that requires a cultural change and a product that should make the cultural change easy and sticky. And that is really what Ally came about. And the reason I named the product Ally and not some OKR stuff is because I want this to be a tool that helps everyone, whether you're the CEO of the company or a frontline employee. I want this to be a partner and help you stay focused on what matters, help you understand why your work matters, and help you stay focused on what matters and not get distracted. And that's why I called it Ally, your partner.
Okay, got it. So let me jump into some more serious stuff. One of the questions I always ask founders is that at early stage, how did you craft your ideal customer profile? How did you frame that? And how did it change over time? You know, that would be like when the thing really started taking off, the ideal customer profile would have gotten refined and more sharper, more accurate, right? From the time when you started. If you can talk about that, that will be very useful.
Yeah. Great question again, Suresh. My ideal customer profile when I started was based on some industry research, right? I mean, startups, we cannot start just with a conviction. A conviction gets you going, but you got to every step think about what you don't know and reduce that, eliminate that risk, right, of your business failing. And one of the risks when I started Ally that I was worried about is there were already other players in the OKR market. They were already well-funded. And I was just worried about what is our niche here, right? What is our vector that helps us win this market? And I required a lot of research, right? I talked to about 70 plus customers. I interviewed them pretty deep in interviews. I went to some of the conferences of these players that were already in the market. So the customer interviews, as well as understanding where the competitors were, gave me some really, really good insights into why we can actually craft a strategy here, thread the needle, to say, to win this market. And what I realized is competitors were coming with what I think is a heavyweight product and were a lot more focused on large enterprises and were also focused more on coming top down from the CEO of the enterprise adopting it. And I felt like OKR should really be for everyone, not just for the CEO or the leadership of the company. And I felt like there is a market here where you can actually have a product-led growth strategy coming from bottom up in enterprise, because that's how agile happened in software development, right? I mean, 20 years ago, we were doing development in waterfall model, if you remember, Suresh, right? And we moved to agile, and agile didn't come in most cases as a top-down edict, right? Nobody said, so should all become agile. It grew from bottom up, and I thought that was a model that OKR should ideally spread in. And the other things I realized was their enterprise focus. They probably were strong in enterprise sales motion, but the mid-market and department level sales were not happening. And in fact, that may be an ideal entry point for introducing OKRs in an enterprise. So a few insights like this led me to believe that the ideal market should be fast-growing companies, and we can actually target smaller organizations or departments within enterprises. That's our initial beachhead. So that was my ICP. And very specifically, I said, of course, you're trying to sell your product, so it has to be something you have to be able to understand a customer and quickly segment and see whether they are in the right focus area or not. So one thing was an observable event, right? So I said, we will focus on funded startups, Series A, B, C startups. And that was our initial focus. And these were growing startups. They just got funded or gotten recently funded, and they were looking to grow. And OKR was something startups are more and more familiar with. And building a tool that was simple and easy to use that allows them to scale the business. And at the same time, our competitors were not focused on these smaller size businesses. So that was my initial ICP. And your next question, I think part of it, Suresh, was how did it change? I mean, we always knew that this is a product. My opinion is OKRs are like agile. 20 years ago, people are just playing with it, experimenting with it. Now, I don't know of any development team, product team that does not do agile. OKRs are going to be like that, is my belief. And so our target is the entire world, but we are just methodical about it. We went from targeting Series A, B, C startups, larger organizations, and from there to large enterprises, customers like Dell and many large enterprise customers. So we kind of expanded our base, but without seeding the market we're already in. We still sell to startups, right? But we just developed additional features and go-to-market motion. So we are now selling into larger businesses, departments and enterprises, mid-market companies. And with the acquisition of Microsoft, this was one of the reasons it was attractive for us is Microsoft is so strong in large enterprises too. And now we'll be able to go after very large enterprises also.
Okay. So actually, that sort of opens up my logical point into next session. See, OKR, like for example, if I'm making, like let's say Kissflow was a workflow software, right? Because the category is workflow when we started. Very easy to position us, right? And then if you say like, you know, Salesforce is a CRM or, you know, SAP is an ERP. But OKR is a new thing. It didn't have a category, right? You know, how did you solve that category problem to position OKR as something like, you know, this is allies, right?
Yeah, actually, I'd say you're asking a phenomenal question, Suresh. I would say give you two answers. See, it is a new category. You are absolutely right. There's not an existing category. And some customers are, in fact, people get confused between OKRs and performance management, right? Is it HR software? So there's confusion with some existing categories, right, as well. So the first thing is, I don't think customers care, to be honest, what category you are in. Whether they have a pain point, they're solving the pain point, they don't care whether you are in this category or that category. You have to be clear that you are not HR software, which I was very, very clear on right from day one. Because some customers will come to us and talk about how do I do performance management, talent calibration, and because the word OKRs is used in different ways. And we'd be very clear that we are about productivity and business performance and not about the individual's performance. We help with that, but that's not our primary focus. So customers really, to be honest, don't care whether you are in a category, whether you're able to name the category you are in. They have a pain point. If you solve it well, they don't care. Where the problem is with VCs, right? The investors, they are trying to actually put you in a box. What is this box? And that was early on a struggle. People used to ask me two things. One is, what is the category you're in? How big is this category? Who are the other players? And the second problem I had was there was a previous generation, they still are around, of OKR software vendors, well-funded people. They did not perform as well. And people asked me, how are you going to be successful? If those guys who also raised 30, 40 million or 50, 100 million were not successful, why would you be successful? And so the category problem as well as the history was mainly in my case with investors only. And to be over a period of time, if you are showing results, showing strong growth and customer retention, investors believe that you're creating a new category. It was not easy, but that was my thing. Customers don't care. With investors, I had to convince them I'm building a new category. And just by delivering on customer satisfaction, customer value and our growth, they came to believe that we are building a category.
Okay, got it. Yeah, but actually, I'm not able to, to persist on this. I simply pass on this category easily for customers also. Because like, for example, it is linked to the next question, which is, was your marketing model inbound driven? If it is inbound driven, they need to know like the category name for which they have to search for it, right? You know, see, the category name is important for discovery because people are not going to search for Ally because the brand is not yet popular, right? Like once you are popular, once your brand becomes similar, synonymous to category, people will directly search for SAP, right? But because then SAP is equivalent to ERP now. Similarly, people directly search for Salesforce because Salesforce is equivalent to CRM. So until that happens, people search for use keywords for the problem. And category is really a proxy for the problem, not necessarily anything else, right?
That's right.
If your marketing, what is your marketing model? And hence, if your marketing model is the inbound model, without having the category, it will be difficult for people to discover you, right? So, and hence my question around category.
Fair enough, Suresh. But as you said yourself, right, people think of the problem first, right? If the problem is so well known, then it becomes already a category and then people start searching for category. And then if your brand gets really well known within the category, people search for your brand, right? That is a progression by which people search. But people start with, I have a problem today, right? I'm not able to keep my team aligned on what matters. I'm not able to move faster, right? This is where all my customer interviews, right? The numerous ones I did help. I started using the words customers repeatedly used. I went to people, business leaders, and asked, what's your number one problem running a business? And that was helpful because it helped to validate what I had in mind, really were the problems people are talking about. Because they're not, without you prompting them, without you telling them, if you build something like this, will you use, which is a bad way to ask the question. If If you ask them what's the number one problem running a business, if they're articulating the problems that your solution is going to solve without any prompting, then you know you have business. If you're not in the top three problems they're articulating, you don't have business, in my opinion. So I was able to also use the same interviews to identify how they were articulating the problems. And they were words like, how do I keep everyone on the same page? How do I keep my team aligned on the top priorities? How do I move faster? How do I have visibility so it's before it's too late, right? So I started actually using those problem statements as a way to actually do demand generation for us. We had to essentially connect the problem to OKRs or our software. In many cases, customers even knew what OKRs were because they were reading books about OKRs. The CEO will read a book and CEO is not yet thinking about what category this is in. They're saying, okay, yeah, I see this. This OKR thing helps with alignment. Alignment is a problem I have. Let me actually have someone go do the research, right? And they are searching for the problem early on, as you said, right? Problem comes very early, then comes category, and then comes the very specific brand within the category. And early on in this category creation, people are searching for the problem, and that's how we did our demand gen.
Okay. So is it like SEO-driven or paid marketing-driven, or is it outbound cold calling? How is the pipeline built, like demand generation pipeline?
Yeah, so good one again, Suresh. Because we are not building yet another CRM, right? We are not CRM for small business or ticketing for small business, right? We were not taking an existing market. We are building a new category and market here, right? It's at least was not a well-known market at that time. And what we did was essentially look for these problems, as I said, in the customer interviews. And then essentially we started using SEM because we don't want to spend too much time on SEO because we want to fail fast, right? Which campaigns, which problems resonate with customers, was something we had to identify very, very quickly. And the SEM was a very good way for us to validate that. And once we validated it and knew which of these messages were really resonating with customers, all the way down to which converted to actual subscriptions, right? Not just clicks or not just interest, but actual purchases and even retention. We went really deep into that funnel and we started actually formalizing the top 3 to 5 messages that resonated well and pretty much then accelerated our SEM and then started bringing in SEO. I like SEO a lot. I mean, we know it's efficient from customer acquisition costs, but early on in the product cycle, because we are a new category, right? Again, if it's CRM, I don't have to do these things. But early on, it's a new category and I'm attacking the problem. I had to validate the messages very quickly and SEO was not the right path. So we used SEM and later on, once we validated it, we still do SEM just in more channels and more places. And then we added SEO. We added cold calling outbound only very late, like only in the last year or so, because our inbound has been extremely very good for us, right? And then slowly the Ally brand also started making more sense to customers. So more people had the problem, more people connected to OKRs, more people started connecting that to Ally. And that started helping us. So inbound was the most vibrant source for us. And then we augmented it only the last year with outbound.
Okay. And mostly it is SEM, which means paid marketing driven rather than SEO driven.
That's right. Again, we use SEM because of the early validation part. And we continue to scale SEM. And we added SEO after that. We added social after that. And then we added outbound.
Okay. And when you started SEM, like paid marketing, what would be like a cost of acquiring a customer for in that case?
Very early on, I mean, depending on what level of problem you're tackling, Suresh, as you know, right? I mean, the eventual problem you're targeting is business agility, business productivity. But those are actually very hard keywords to target, right? They're very, very expensive. So early on, we were actually targeting a segment of people who already knew OKRs and they're not able to do OKRs on spreadsheets on PowerPoint, which is where I was in my previous company. And so that was very narrow targeted ads where the conversion was high. Cost was low because you're targeting a very specific set of people. Right? There's not a lot of competition for those keywords. And I think we were paying more like $2 for a visit and maybe $30 for a conversion. I forgot now the numbers. It was very low. And the CAC to LTV was super high for us. Right? Then as you expand the market, right, going back to your earlier question, starting from an ICP to, okay, now it's not just about people who know OKRs who are not able to do that well. How do you actually get to go after people who kind of know OKRs, but not thinking about should we try it or not, right? That actually becomes more expensive because it's slightly higher up in the funnel. The keywords are broader, so it's more expensive. And then you start to go after business leaders who are thinking about the problem even more broadly, business agility, which is even more expensive. But early on, our cost was, because of how we focus on the ICP, it was actually pretty low for us. I don't know the exact numbers, but it was pretty low.
So here I have some questions like, okay, now that we talked a little bit about it, you have free version also or you have paid version only?
We decided not to free. We have a free trial. It's a 2-week trial. We experimented with 3 weeks, 4 weeks and all, and we picked 2 weeks, but we don't have a free version.
So how many customers does Ale have?
Since we launched the product, I think we accumulated now a little over 1,000 customers, all only paying, of course, right? Yep.
Sure. When did you start adding sales teams? Is this like a self-service product? People come, sign up, try, and then they buy using their credit card? Or do you have to have salespeople to do that? Well, I'll just tell you, when we started Workflow, we actually didn't have salespeople. We felt our people are signing up, and when they're getting stuck in terms of how to use the product, you only had pre-sales people. And they simply help the customer succeed. And then at the end of it, they don't sell or anything. They simply ask, okay, now that everything is working for you, why don't you put your credit card and buy it, right? So that's our sales at that time. So just trying to understand how it used to work for us.
Yeah, that's a smart model, Suresh. That's how it should work. In our case, because a new category, right? Customers will be like, oh, I've been trying hard with this. How will this work? And we also support a lot of integrations too, right? So, and finally, our case was different because it's a new category and we have to tell people what to even expect in software. Right? How do you do OKRs using software? It's not like they already used to hearing about Salesforce and they just want to know what Salesforce for small business looks like, right? So it was, in our case, a lot of education was needed. We did a lot of that through our content and through our trial experience itself. But we did actually have, I would actually hop on calls, almost pre-sales like things, like and show customers the full capability of the product, how to use it. But we also started selling into mid-market early on, right? I mean, within 2 months of launching the product, we had customers like Slack. While they were trialing it, they also still wanted to see a full demo and they were not going to do an online contract. Right. So we, because of the traction we had with these big brand names very early on, actually, I was a sales guy at that time, but I did build a sales team within the first few months, just 2 people. And then we scaled it up from there.
Okay. When you ended, how big is the sales team?
Currently, we have about 40 people, I think.
Okay.
Roughly about 40. Yeah.
Okay. And all of this is remote selling or is it like field sales or is it inside sales?
Pretty much all remote. Right. We don't have any field sales. It is all inside sales. Very rarely we have gone to customer sites, but I mean, we are able to close. I mean, also the pandemic kind of made it a necessity to do remote sales. But even before the pandemic, that was not our model. We're not going to go after field sales. We're targeting mainly mid-market customers and departments in large enterprises. And we were able to successfully close them remotely.
See, one of the challenges, since we also do the same thing, right? We all do have inside sales and remote sales. Now we are trying to expand into field sales. One of the challenges like doing big ticket sales using remote sales and inside sales, right? So what is the typical ticket size for Ale?
I mean, the average before our acquisition would be around 50. And now the large deals would be 250K ARR, annual contract value, and ARR will be that. And the big ones, we're closing like in 200K range as well, right? We were closing deals like Facebook and Riot Games and Zillow and those also remotely larger deals for us, right? But we were never in deals that were like millions of dollars.
Okay. And these 50K is fine. But these salespeople were located in the US or they're in India. What is their India-US split and what happened in India and what happened in the US?
Yeah. I mean, we also now have an UKI team. So we have these 3 regions from where we do sales. Our India team is focused essentially on our SMB business. And our US team is primarily focused on mid-market and enterprise in North America. And our UK Ireland team is focused on primarily UK and Ireland, but also EU. And they cover that region because that requires, as you know very well, some additional understanding of region-specific needs.
Okay. And what will be a typical on-target OTE for a US region?
Yeah, we were doing about 720. We increased it a little bit because things were going well at the time. And with the micro acquisition, we think things are going to go even better. But it was 720 here, or 750, mate.
750 is the target for a...
Yeah, OTE. Yeah, OTE target.
On target earnings. And you pay like a 250K or with a 50% base?
It was not quite 250, it was slightly less than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the problems is like I actually used OKR software and I have a video. I think, I don't know whether you have seen my video on OKR. There is a 20-minute video that I did on OKR software.
Oh, cool. I'll see it next time, Suresh. That's cool, man.
Yeah, actually, I feel it's a good one. A lot of people have seen it and told me it's one of the good software.
Nice.
After that, we used Purdue, actually.
Purdue, yeah. They were one of the players that were in the market well before. They were in the market 5-6 years before we even started. And yeah, there's another product called Betterworks as well. And there's another one called GTM Hub. And there were like 4 guys who had been in the market like 5 years before we even started. And yeah, Purdue was one of them.
OKR is a very systematic and disciplined approach, right? And it requires a lot of mindset change. And one of the biggest mindset changes, people always go to activity mindset rather than outcome mindset. Yep. And you know, the first time I started writing OKRs and people came back and showed this is my OKR, they only had all activities.
Okay? Yes.
And I have to conduct training programs internally myself because even my director level people, even VP level people, they wrote only activities.
Yep.
They are also not, because it required a lot of mind shift that required people to stop thinking activities and start thinking outcomes and then work backwards and see what activities I need to do to get to the outcomes, right? And hence, most OKR systems, you know, the biggest challenge will be, this is a very deep concept there, right? And it looks very easy on the outside, but when you try to implement it, right? And very, very deep understanding is required. And hence, after some time, people give up, which means it directly affects a churn because the renewals won't happen, right?
Yes.
The first year purchase will happen, renewals won't happen because the adoption is very tough because the concept is tough to internalize. So what is, and hence my question is like, how is the renewal rate and churn and how are you managing that? And how are you, what is the strategy that you have for onboarding and adoption and continuous education so that the whole thing is ingrained into the system? If you can speak around that, it will be very useful.
Oh, awesome, man. This is a great topic. Suresh, this will take some time, at least 5 minutes to talk about it. This was a topic of another internal Microsoft thing I did yesterday too, right? This is where the power and the struggle of OKRs are both, right? Sure. You cannot get great outcomes by creating OKRs yet as some project management tool you're rolling out, right? So it does require a culture habit change, but anything worthwhile in life takes time. And it's not that easy to just quickly roll it out and suddenly see productivity increasing 2x, 4x, right? So it's a worthwhile endeavor, but you're absolutely right. It might look easy, but what you have to realize is you're changing the culture of your company, right? It takes time, right? You have smart people, but they've grown up in a particular way. Think all the previous managers told them to nail their goal 100%. And suddenly when you come in and say, it's okay to reach goals, set such goals and you reach 70%, it's like, what the heck is going on, right? So it is, but it's the right thing to do. It takes some time.
So I was asking, like, because of the exact same problems that you are saying, right? Like, after you saw the video, you realized how much understanding it requires for someone to internalize and implement OKR into the system. And we are still not, like, perfect in that. And hence, my question is, it is probably easy to get the first year sale done unless it's deeply internalized. People are not going to say, you know what, we are using it, so I'm not going to renew it. So how are you doing the onboarding and usage? Because it's related to deep concepts. Actually, I can relate to this very well because when we developed the low-code platform, we thought, you know, we'll give a tool and do all these things. But then we realized building an application is not just about tools. They need to understand the notion of data model, the notion of business logic. Where does the logic fit into that? What comes in front end? What goes into back end? Unless they understand that, they just can't still build the application, right? So beyond the tool, there seems to be a lot of solutioning that needs to be done to build an application. So we can totally relate to the concept of tool versus the underlying concept issue. We call this the semantic gap, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is a semantic gap between like the way human beings think and the way computer thinks. And even you give a tool, unless the human beings cross that semantic gap, they won't be able to use the tool. So, and I saw a similar pattern. So the question really is, how did you solve that problem? And hence, how did you arrest the churn? You know, that would be useful for the audience.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And you're absolutely right, Suresh, because what we are trying to do is transform an organization, right? This is not like yet another project management tool. right? Where you just say, oh, put it in, and instead of tasks, call it items or whatever. It's not one of those. This is a really fundamental and deep change. And you are creating habits, breaking old ones. It's not very easy. In fact, your YouTube video, you talk about how it's so easy for people have been trained to think on outputs. What did I do? What did I deliver, right? Not to think harder about what is the impact. That is even harder for most people. And that is just individual level, right? But there are cultural aspects. In fact, at Cronus, I mean, we all hire A-class players, right? And I remember this marketing person, she was phenomenally good. And she comes in and I will tell her, we have set stretch goals and it's okay if you hit 70%. And she'll just look at me like I'm crazy because she's like used to hitting 110% of her goals. Why would I ever not hit 100% of my goals, right? That's not part of an ethos. Part of winning is 100%. For most of us, it is. So it is a cultural transformation too on helping people understand that this is about learning. This is not about just hitting the goal once. And why stretch goals and ambitious goals are interesting and all that stuff. So there's a cultural aspect. There's a habit. There's a lot of things. And we actually used to see several customers talk about, hey, we tried to use it, didn't work. It failed, right? Even what you said, Suresh, right? That we tried it a couple of times, didn't work. And that actually shows this. You have to look at it at the right lens, right? There's not a project management tool. There's not some simple methodology. For me, the closest analogy is agile, right? When I was at Microsoft last time around, right? We used to do development waterfall model. And we kind of shifted towards agile over a period of time. Back then, it was pretty uncertain. Is agile the way to go? So in fact, some of my peers tried agile and said, oh, that didn't work. There's no accountability in agile, went back to waterfall. But it's a transformation, right? You help people think about, wow, you have to think about sprints. It's okay if the burn down chart is actually getting close to zero, right? And it's a completely different way of thinking about project management. Now, of course, everyone has adopted it. It's just natural. But it took quite some time for people to remember those days. I think OKRs are like that because of the principles embedded in it. The principles are pretty simple, but old habits are hard to change. So what we did, right? One of the early teams I formed was actually a customer success team. I think I formed it right around the time I formed my sales team. So it was a very early bet because at the end of the day, it's due to two reasons. One is all for like pretty much every organization, Allies, it's an extremely customer focused organization, right? We always start with did we create customer value and work backwards from there. What does it take to create customer value? And we could see that for several customers, I mean, there's a OKR maturity graph we have, Suresh, I'll talk about it at another time. But we were explicitly targeting customers who had tried OKRs, were doing it in spreadsheets, and were just struggling to make it work and they're pulling their hair out, right? But then we're also seeing a set of customers who have heard about OKRs, got excited, want to try it out. It is depending on the customer's familiarity with OKRs, some customers are struggling a lot, some customers are generally fine. In fact, there are customers who told us, we get this, just give us a software, we are fine. And they were doing very well. They're growing, they're deploying to more and more people. But increasingly, we are seeing a large number of customers who are quite early on. They tried it, but they failed, or they just don't know how to do it well. So we formed a customer success team. The team now has five components, but at the time, the number one was not technical deployment, not training, but how do you actually help customers with this change management? The word we used was change management, which is a transformation, right, in an organization. And we would actually go coach the customers. I would actually tell my team, this is our project. This is not customer's project. This transformation is our ownership. And we can help the customer. We should think of this as that level of ownership and help the customer be successful. And that is really where we us taking the ownership and making sure that we are focused on the customer's deployment being successful. So we would actually be in the quarterly reviews. We would actually watch the traction and give them feedback on this is where you can train that team, or you can this is where we can come in and even help your leadership team, or here's material for you to go coach in this team. Whether it's a train the trainer or we are involved, we took a lot of ownership for customer success. And that was actually one of the, in my opinion, game changers for us. But I can go into details, Suresh.
I'm a little bit curious about this because having personally implemented it, I'm still finding it struggling to delegate this responsibility to define, question, shape a OKR of a leader. Like, for example, let's say a product leader or a marketing leader or a sales leader. Unless I do it, I'm not able to delegate this. For example, I have an equally very talented HR person, people person, actually. He's very senior. He did his PhD in organizational behavior, and he's very passionate, very intelligent, everything top class guy. But still, it's difficult for him to go and you know, if somebody puts together an OKR and to say, hey, this is not okay, you need to change this, you need to change that, this still looks like activities, it needs to be, all that is still not possible. So though I'm hence wondering, because we face the same problem for KissFlow, when we try to hire people who can do customer success for us, they need to have the solution architecture kind of a knowledge. Now, the solution architecture knowledge comes with tremendous amount of experience of having done. Even actually, I feel Alay's problem is more complex than our KissFlow problem. At least in KissFlow, after 10 years, you will find somebody who's a good solution architect and hire him and then But here I'm saying like only a CEO kind of person who knows like marketing sales. You know, if you talk to a marketing guy, I need to know like, okay, this is how it connects. I need to tell them, okay, this OKR is not going to work. This is not going to tie there. So how do you find these like superhumans, right? Like customer success people in your company, you would have to be really to, and also on the other side, there are very senior guys. And unless if I talk to somebody like on the other side, yeah, they will respect me. But if I hire somebody like 5 years experience, 3 years experience guy on going on the other side, some CMO.
Talking to the CEO. Yeah.
Talk to a CEO, CMO was like 15 years experience, a veteran. He said, who is this guy, right? He's coming and telling me this is not okay. How do you really hire these people and solve these problems?
Yeah. Like, so multiple things, Suresh, right? I mean, it's a very good question. Again, I can see you are living this, right? Our journeys are very similar. We are facing similar problems. There are two parts to your question. One is, hey, how do you actually, not one was about staffing. How do you find people like that to help customers, right? Second is what happens inside the customer's organization? Because if you're always needing this push from outside, the habit has not taken hold. The moment the push goes away, the habit goes away. And then Alay renewal doesn't happen, right? So our goal has always been that we're going to actually train the customer, right? But we're going to do the initial handholding. And again, I saw this in the Agile, Suresh. We, in fact, at Microsoft had Agile coaches and all this stuff. Every vendor will have them initially. Then it became a habit and we know how to do this well, right? Now it's a very well understood concept, lots of books, videos, whatever, right? To get started on Agile. That is the state we are trying to get OKRs to. When it's done well, it's magic, right? It just brings purpose to people, business accelerates, aligned, everything. It's fantastic. But doing it well, it's not like turning on a switch, right? So our goal though is that we want the customer to have the habit. We cannot be the external one, right? So we look at our job as almost like we are trainers. And up until a particular point, we're going to help the customers train and then build the habits and then we're going to slowly disengage. So that's our motto. We are not, every time we are like, hey, are we the crutch or are we the enabler, right? And we want to be the enabler, number one. Number two is, as part of that, in fact, we actually tell customers, even before we start a project, hey, these are the kinds of people you want to have on your side. Who is your OKR champion for the organization? The small organization, like 100, 200 people, a single OKR champion is fine. And who is your sponsor? Are you the sponsor? Because somebody needs to tell the entire organization why you are doing this. OKR champion, maybe a program manager for all you know, right? Somebody needs to have that baton and say, this is why this is important for the business. And they need to evangelize and they need to be senior enough. But they don't have to sit down and craft each and every OKR for every department. Typically, it should be the OKR champion who understands the concept. He or she becomes an internal coach of the organization.
And how senior that person has to be? And is it a full-time role or a...
It depends, Suresh. In some companies, it's actually a full-time role, right? In many companies, so when they start the journey, this is actually somebody who's just passionate about OKRs. They read a lot about it and they are helping the company start the journey. And so they're somewhat proficient. Maybe they have been doing OKRs within the team and now they've been asked to step up and do it for the entire organization. But somebody who is familiar and deeply interested and passionate about this topic, but they may not know exactly how to do it at a particular scale or how to do it in a repeated, scalable way, right?
And our job, okay, for example, if I have to hire someone like that for KissFlow, how do I spot that person?
Yeah. So typically where I find them is actually people who do project management and change management or business strategy, right? Those are the roles. Now, business strategy can sometimes be the ivory tower stuff. OKRs are very practical. You need somebody to drive this. But they are actually, typically those are the people. In fact, even our customer success people, many of them, we hired for strategy consultants. And they were familiar with OKRs. But after joining Alay, they became really, really good at learning OKRs. Sometimes from internally from each other. But sometimes even working with customers, we are also still learning how to do this well as an organization. But they became really, really good. The strategic part, working with, say, executives at the other side, they're all pretty natural skills they already had. And we could actually add the OKR domain expertise to them. Sometimes it's actually, depending on the type of customer, it is someone who is coming from a very good project management background. And they are moving from project management to strategy, while the strategy consultants are actually coming down from pure strategy consultant to practical application. So we want to find people in that band that overlaps project management, execution, and strategy.
Okay. And like one of the things I was just thinking, I'm just trying to see if practically approach this. Like I used to wonder what a chief of staff for a CEO would do in a slightly larger company, right? I'm just thinking, do you think somebody like that can actually own this and then sort of
execute? Yeah, good question, Suresh. Most often, actually, the chief of staff owns this, right? Okay. Chief of staff of the department leader or the CEO, depending on the size of the company, right? It's a chief, but in a very large organization, they usually have office for strategy transformation or business operations, or even the CFO, COO office takes responsibility for it. The larger the organization, the more sophisticated the execution function is, and they actually take over and run it. Sometimes we've seen HR do it, but most times it's someone on the business side.
Business side, okay. And so it naturally means that you're only targeting companies who have evolved to that level. At least they have like 500 employees or so, because they have to pay. If you remember, you said your average ticket size is 50K per year or something like that.
It was growing to that stage, but we have customers all the way. I mean, we have a 2-week trial, Suresh, and then we have customers who can sign up for as little as 10 user license. Right. And so we have the self-serve motion, right, where we have those customers. And then we have our sales-led motion, and now increasingly an enterprise motion, which is where the big tickets are happening.
So what do
but we cater to all these.
What is the split between self-serve percentage versus mid-market versus enterprise?
I mean, it's been changing. So when I started the company, it was all mostly self-serve, right? Because I didn't have the credibility to get even mid-market customers. But within 2-3 months, we started seeing customers like Slack, and then it increased and increased. But anything less than 5,000 has been our sweet spot for the longest time. Because as I told you last time, when we entered the market, there are people who are trying to cater to an enterprise-level OKR market, right? Our solution, we thought, was a better approach for the reasons I talked about last time. But it takes some time to build the enterprise muscle, whether it's go-to-market or solutioning, right? Our customer success. And we want to go into that. Now, even before the Microsoft acquisition, but definitely after Microsoft acquisition, we are moving even more into the enterprise. I would say that about 70-80% of our revenue was in the mid-market, and maybe 10-15% on the enterprise side and 5-10% on the revenue-wise, right? Customer count-wise, of course, is different because self-serve customers are smaller revenue customers.
Sure, sure. Oh, okay. Got it. So you're saying like mid-market is the...
It was. This was about 6 months ago. Now things have changed a lot, right? Microsoft brand brings a lot of credibility into enterprise, and we're getting more and more enterprise.
And you also have a huge army of enterprise sales guys because of Microsoft.
I mean, they have this unbelievable relationships too, right? So one of the world's most trusted brands when it comes to business software.
Yeah. Right?
And layering on top of what they're already selling should be natural motion. I mean, we're still new to Microsoft, right? We are still learning how to, and we're teaching.
How do you get this large enterprise sales team to, they have a huge bouquet of offering when they go to enterprise customers.
Yeah.
And they know what to sell.
Yeah.
And how do you prioritize your product, their bouquet, and how do you incentivize?
Yeah. Two things, Suresh. One is actually demand in the market itself, right? A lot of customers are trying to figure out what is this modern work experience, given what's happening in the world for the last several years, right? Mm-hmm. Pre-pandemic, but definitely after the pandemic started. There is a lot of, I mean, CEOs are trying to figure out what's happening in my team. I can't see my team anymore. How do I actually run my company? How do I actually make sure everything's aligned? So modern work is just a big topic, and we neatly fit into that modern work, right? When people think about modern work. So when you have an enterprise team that actually has a customer relationship and the customer's asking about modern work, we actually educate them on what is modern work and where Ally fits into that. And that is one. The second is oftentimes we see the awareness of OKRs increasing a lot in companies, but they are like, oh, Microsoft now can do OKRs. So there's a trusted brand that does OKRs. They are initiating the conversation very specifically about OKRs. Can you tell us what you're doing with OKRs?
Okay. I got it.
Our tickets are still small, as you pointed out, but hopefully in the next couple of years, it'll be big enough. Like we'll have a dedicated sales force who's making hundreds of millions on just this.
So one important question I want to talk about is the acquisition by Microsoft. And I know you were ex-Microsoft, and there is always a very easy thing to assume that, you know, you had all the internal knowledge, interconnections, and, you know, it's easy to go to within Microsoft and find out who's, you know, the internal org charts and all of that, right? To be able to navigate and say, you know what, this is where it fits in and articulate the value proposition and also articulate how strategic it is. So probably you also have some ex-colleagues who know if Microsoft is working on that and they would need it and all of that, right?
So tell us about that story, if that is how it happened, or like if people are looking to do some sort of a strategic acquisition or alignment or partnership with big companies like that, how do they go about and how it happened for you? All of that would be very useful for the audience.
Got it. Awesome. So I'll share my journey. I can't go into too many details, right, about the actual acquisition. We did not initiate this. So let me start from there. Microsoft reached out to us sometime way back, like I think it was November of 2020, right? And because they were building, Microsoft building this massive category called Viva. It's around modern employee experience and how do you improve the experience and engagement. And they, I think, saw a need for an OKR-like product as part of the Viva, right? I actually read about Viva, and to be honest, I fell in love with it. I said, wow, what a timely product from a trusted brand. This is going to do phenomenally well. That's my conclusion. But when they reached out, I was keen on a partnership. I said, hey, maybe my module can be just part of this ecosystem because Microsoft builds platforms, right? And all third parties can plug in. And so when it sounded like it was an acquisition, to be honest, we were not terribly interested. The way Microsoft came about to Ally is Microsoft was a very professionally run company. They didn't come to me because somebody there knew Vettery, right? I mean, I'll talk about that part a little later, right? How the familiarity did help, but they did not find Ally because of that. They actually had a product strategy. They thought this could be a good fit. And then they said, which is the best OKR product in the market? They don't buy the second or third players, right? They have the money to buy the best player. And they also thought about, should we build it, right? Build or buy, and then you kind of buy, be successful. And they, in the internal research, showed some phenomenal results, right? Ally, by customer satisfaction, was the highest ranked product in the market. And it was 2x, our customer side was 2x of the next competitor. I cannot go into the names of the other people. And that is what actually attracted them to Ally in the first place. It was not, and then they figured out the guy who's running the company is ex-Microsoft guy. That actually kind of helps them because they always have to think about the integration risk. That is really where the fact I gave was much, but for them, this was the choice, right?
Talk about integration risk. Was it more cultural employee or is it technology?
Cultural. Okay. Microsoft is very, I mean, particularly under Satya, but even before, it's a very culture-focused organization. And they don't acquire companies if they don't think it's a culture fit for them. So the fact that this can be a culture fit was actually definitely happy, made them happy. But they came about it because they had a product strategy. They did market research. They found Ally to be the best product. That's why they reached out to us. So it just, actually, to be honest, we didn't initiate anything. I remember, to be honest, thinking, wow, Microsoft wants to enter this market. If they enter, what should I do? Right? Because I didn't want to sell. How do I handle this? And that was my take.
That's always tricky.
Yeah, exactly, right? And
it happened to us also, right? We had Workflow and Microsoft launched Flow. But luckily, the name was similar, but it was actually doing what Zapier was doing. So we were a bit worried. And then they did Power Apps. And then again, we were like, oh my God. And then we looked at what Power Apps did. And then we said, okay, fine. I have two questions here. One is, how big was Ally when the acquisition happened? And you said October 20 is when they reached out.
November of 2020. Yeah.
How long did it took to do the deal? And what are the difficulties? I mean, who negotiated the deal? You did it yourself, or did somebody from the board handle it? Because when you try to do it yourself, you don't have the buffer to sort of say no, yes, or negotiate or come up with all the. So tell us a little bit about that also.
Yeah. So I negotiated the deal myself. There was actually a suggestion of maybe we bring in a banker and staff, but the Microsoft interest was genuine and very high, right? And to be honest, I didn't want to sell the company, as I told you, right? We were doing very well, man. We had our next round lined up at $1 billion plus valuation and everything. And for us, this would have been a change in direction, right? A change that we didn't really need, to be honest. But it was super exciting. What happened to me was I was initially very, very unsure about why we would go down this path at all, because we are on a very good path. I mean, our revenues were small. I mean, pretty good for a three-year-old company. We are going 3x year over year and all that good stuff. And our net retention rate was like NRR was 142% or something, because most of our customers are just growing, right? Really, really well. We had customers who started like 10K and 250K within 1 year, right? And so product was resonating. The team we had built, actually a good team. We had pretty seasoned people who had taken companies to even 100 million in revenue and so on. So we were in a good place. But one of the conversations with Microsoft, I think someone senior, might have been Kirk or Rajesh, somebody very senior was on the call. Kirk is my boss now. He runs all of Viva. And he has built multi-billion dollar businesses in the company, like security business and all the stuff, right? And Viva is the business he's trying to build now. And I think Rajesh or Kirk was talking about it. Vitri, this is not, they said something that resonated with me. They said something along the lines of, Vitri, this is not just about how you come and help Microsoft, but this is about how Microsoft helps to amplify the mission you care about, right? Microsoft can amplify the mission 1,000 times, right? Hundreds of millions of users. That's when, to be honest, Suresh, my mind changed. Because I said, man, I can raise hundreds of millions. We already had the round lined up and stuff. But that will not get me hundreds of millions of users, right? So it came down to, what did I care more about? What I realized for myself was, I, for some reason, didn't care too much about standing at NASDAQ and ringing the bell. I mean, it's an amazing achievement. For me, it was not a big deal. The thing I did care a lot about was independence. I wanted to pursue the passion, or the mission we have with passion. And that independence, I was worried, will get diluted if I am part of a larger company. And that is really where I spent a lot of time thinking about it. And I wrote a memo for my board, because I want to make sure my board and me, we work very well together. Even though I was fronting the negotiation, we were collaborating pretty much on a daily, weekly basis on what was going on, how do we approach it. And I wrote a memo to my board. Up until that point, I was like, yeah, I'm not sure what to do here. How do we handle this? But that day I wrote a memo saying, this is the right thing for the company. Right? I still wasn't sure of the right thing for me, but it was the right thing for the company. Right? To get this mission, get this product in the hands of hundreds of millions of people. We also have this mantra, right? One of our core values is, we will be where work happens, right? It cannot be yet another tool. And it turns out for most of the world, 90% of the world, work happens on Microsoft platform, right? And so it was a phenomenal fit. And for me, it came down to, do I value my independence or this acceleration to the mission? And I just came to the realization after a lot of back and forth where I confused the heck out of my board, that I cared more about the mission than even my own independence. And that is really where it came down. It was not an easy call at all for me. Microsoft valuation was extremely generous, but I could have shopped the deal around and gotten even a better deal, but I did not. Because I really thought this was the right fit and the mission would be the best served here. And so far, better standard to be true.
Meaning, I was just Googling some numbers. Is this the acquisition value or public or anything? Or is it?
No, it's not public. It's not public. And there's some stuff on the net. I don't think it's correct. Somebody sent me something. I don't know what is this on the net. I'm not searching. But somebody sent me something and that was not correct.
Okay, sure. So, meaning, when you do M&A like this, do they squeeze you out, or what do founders need to look for in the negotiation, or maybe generally flexible, or how does
that? Every company is different there, Suresh. Microsoft, again, is gold standard in my opinion. I'm told that some other companies like Salesforce are also very, very good. But Microsoft is gold standard in my opinion, because I have been on the other side of the table when I was inside Microsoft before. Microsoft handles with very high degree of integrity throughout the entire process. Even the due diligence, after you sign the letter of intent, they do not look at your code. A third party looks at the code. That's the due diligence for them. It's really, really handled very, very well by the company. So I didn't feel like they were squeezing me out at all. They had done their model. Based on the model, they had a number in mind. And again, very, very disciplined. They're walked away from deals. They don't just say, oh, that somebody's competing, let's keep competing. They don't do that. And I was transparent with them about the funding offer I already had. And I'm sure that was part of the input they took into consideration. And they came up with an offer. We were able to negotiate it. They negotiated in good faith. We negotiated in good faith. It's never fun, right? Having these negotiations with Carb Dev and stuff. But Microsoft, actually, I like the professionalism with which Microsoft people handle. There are times where we are like, okay, this is not going to work for us. There are times where they said, this is not going to work for us. And we both parties meant it genuinely, right? It's not posturing. And it took quite some time. I think it took like 4 or 5 weeks before we agreed on the number and some key terms. But I was doing a negotiation. I had a lot of help from my board, right? And also I had an advisor who has done a lot of M&A work. He was very, very helpful.
So I also want to talk, change from M&A stuff. Meaning, one last question on M&A is, you said like your funding round is like $1 billion valuation or something like that, right? But then my gut feel is that it was not $1 billion acquisition. Right? How do you trade off such a huge gap in acquisition versus and go for that, right?
Yeah. See, I think there are two ways to look at it, right? One is, what is right for your team and investors? The second is, what's right for the mission, or you can even say me, right? But everyone cares about the mission of the company, not just me. For the team and the investors, people did really, really well. Within 3 years, we had a phenomenal exit, right? Pretty much every investor did at least 2 to 3x their IRR number. Even the ones that did the last round, the Series B, or Series C round as well. So everyone did very, very well. In 3 years, some people got like 40x and so on, right? So investors did very, very well. So I didn't I mean, we could have done even more for them, but it was IRR-wise, it was one of the phenomenal outcomes for them. For the team was actually getting a very good deal in most cases from Microsoft. The way Microsoft did it, they were very generous, right? Because they wanted the team. They didn't just want the technology.
When you say the deal in terms of the role and the salary?
The role and even salary compensation was very good. In many cases, people actually were able to keep the Ally options, also get Microsoft options kind of 2x. So it was a very, very good, Microsoft treats people very well. And they were not trying to squeeze people out or something. I mean, not everyone did as well, but pretty much everyone did, right? There are some exceptions. So the team was well taken care of. Investors were well taken care of. So for me, and the mission was more important than, can we make another few $100 million, right? I've been very fortunate in my life, Suresh. I was at Microsoft during the very early stages of growth. And it's not like you can eat more or sleep more when you have more money. That's true for almost all of us, right? And what are you going to do? The mission is something I genuinely care a lot about. Yes, could I make 2x the money? But you also have to remember, VC puts in 10% of the money and says, you're worth a billion, right? For Microsoft, they put in the 100% of the money, right? So some of it is VC is make-believe money, right? It's like, I wouldn't say monopoly money, but it's make-believe money, right? They put in small percentage and then, okay, here's 100 million, but it's worth 2 billion. Okay, really? Okay, why don't you put in 2 billion then?
Actually, I was going to ask about the VC question, and you naturally alluded to that. A lot of times these M&As, right, they say it's like brokered by the VC. Somebody sits on this board, somebody sits on that board, and then goes into the enterprises and then sell their startups so that they get the money back and stuff like that, right? So all these stories are there on the internet. In this particular case, what was the role of the investors, venture capitalists in the acquisition?
Or did they play? I mean, our investors are very supportive, Suresh, in the end, but they didn't really pay. I mean, the board members were involved in helping me, and one advisor was helping me a lot during the negotiation, how should we think about it? But that was after we decided this makes sense, right? Then it was a matter of, can we, is the price right? And price was already, I thought, very generous. And the multiples we got were phenomenal, right? Phenomenal multiples for a full cash transaction again, right? In my opinion, you have to take a full cash transaction, multiply it by at least 3-4 times. Then you get the VC grant valuation, right? And seriously, somebody
can
giving
you real full cash. Can you give us multiple numbers? Like, is it 20x, 30x, something like that in the range?
We got close to 100x.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we, even VCs will give you only that much, right? But VCs are, I mean, we were getting very good valuations, Suresh, because the potential, the TAM of the market.
100x multiple. Microsoft gave you 100x multiple exit.
Close to it. I can't go into too many details, but close to that. It was really, really generous, in my opinion, for a company of our size. So it was a mission, and the IRR was great for the team, was great. Now, could we always make more money? Yeah, we can, right? Could we have built even a bigger business? Yeah, but we're going to build it even faster inside the company. This is going to be a $5 billion business in less than 5 years, right? And that is something I'm excited by. Now, I'm not an independent business. I'm not independent, right? I have a boss. But that is, it never stopped me before. I'm super excited to have the opportunity to build a multi-billion dollar business in a relatively short period of time and give access. Multiples are very, very positive, but I can't go too much into details. Your question, though, was what did the board do with that M&A? So our board members were... I mean, Microsoft reached out to us. They didn't do much. Right?
Yeah, that's,
I mean, our board members were very supportive, though, right? Yeah, very supportive. When I reached out, they were very, they gave me great feedback on both sides. Most of them were balanced about how I should think about it, right? I also called a lot of angel investors, Suresh. Many of them were entrepreneurs, and they also gave me great advice because I was struggling to make their call, right? Mission versus independent was tough for me.
So I want to ask one last question or segment around hiring, culture, and all of that, right? So how big was Ally when acquisition happened? Like 100 people?
It was more than 250 people.
250. Yeah. So, right, that's a sizable number. And I start believing that the startup culture is intact until you hit the 3-digit number, right? Until you hit the 3-digit number, like, it's somewhat manageable because you literally know everybody by name, right? Now, if I go into my left, this is left next to me, and then I have to see their badge and say, oh, they are coming to Kiss Flow. So how do you hire people who align with the culture, not necessarily stereotypes? How do you do that? And the second one is, like, especially senior people, right? That would be very interesting to understand.
Yeah.
And you said most of the salespeople are regionally located, right? Like,
we have a lot of people in Seattle, but some sprinkle around the US, and a lot in Chennai, but some sprinkle around India, right? That's, and we have a few, actually, just a handful of people in UK, right? UK and Ireland. But Suresh, my case was a little odd, man. Even 100%, right, knowing the team well is not something I had the liberty, because most of my team was hired and built after the pandemic, right? I mean, just to give you an idea, just 2 years ago, this company was about 15 people, right? 5 people sitting in India, Seattle, and 10 people in Chennai, right? In 2 years, we got to close to 275 or something when the transaction happened. So that most of that growth happened when I could not see people in person. The last time I visited India was February of 2020, right? Just before the pandemic hit, right? And we hired about 200 plus people, 220, 230 people in that 2 year window during the pandemic, right? So for me, that liberty of knowing people was not always there. So we had to find other ways to know people, right? So building the culture, hiring was the most important job I did. I would be on every interview, even after we had 200 people. I used to do a lot of the new employee orientation, right? I used to talk about myself, not because I didn't trust my HR team. I had a phenomenal HR team. The person who was kind of head of HR for Flipkart was doing my HR, right? Awesome, awesome people. But I thought about this as such an important thing that people had to hear that directly from me. So the culture values is something I try to bring into the interview process and the new employee orientation, our monthly town halls, weekly uploads. We talk about our culture, our kudos. We are not focused on, here's a person who got 200% of sales, but focused on our values. Here's a person who is living our values. We rarely gave kudos. We gave kudos to those as well, extraordinary achievements. But almost all kudos were focused on values. So that was something we did to constantly communicate. I mean, we had a rhythm, right? We had a weekly, what I call as upload, and then the monthly town hall, and we had our OKR process. So there are a lot of connects we'll have with the team. And I was also the kind of person I am. I'm deeply involved in the product and business side. So I got to know most people personally, even at that size. But we had these rhythms that helped us to reinforce the culture.
Okay. Sounds fantastic. And any closing comments before we wind up? It's your last 1 or 2 minutes, whatever you want to say. I thoroughly enjoyed this session. It was fantastic, actually.
No, thanks, Suresh, for this opportunity. Seriously, I feel like the journey of an entrepreneur is so lonely, right? And I benefit a lot from entrepreneurs like you and others talking. I mean, you, I didn't have a chance to interact, but folks like you, I've learned a lot from each other. I think it's a responsibility all of us have. None of us has the answer, right? Some of us have been made, got to higher revenue than others, but we are all equally capable and we have to learn from each other and share our mistakes as well. So we can learn from our mistakes too. So I really appreciate this opportunity to share my learnings and my mistakes. So it helps other entrepreneurs. One thing I would say though is I found joy in pursuing problems I deeply care about, right? I did not look at business. I did not say, oh, there is not a CRM for small business, right? Or whatever it is, right? I mean, there's a way to segment the market. I never looked at things that way. I looked at this as what is the problem I deeply care about? And I knew why I cared about it. And that actually brought a lot of joy. I mean, scaling a company like Ally in 3 years, starting from having just a handful of employees to 300 plus employees and customers and Microsoft acquisition is going to be hard. And there's a lot of bumps along the way. A lot of times I thought, oops, what's going to happen to the company tomorrow? Right? But the passion I had and the belief I had in what we are doing is the right thing is what kept me going. And I just encourage people, if I had only one lesson to share, it'll be find a problem you deeply care about. The business might pivot and start selling to this base. You might sell to some other base, but find a problem you deeply care about.
Fantastic. You know, because that resonates well with me because we have been on that mission for more than 15 years.
Yeah, exactly. That's what keeps going, right? Yeah. I'm sure you are having great days and not so great days, right? And
but you know, going. Every day we wake up and go to office because we are excited about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Awesome.
It was fantastic.
Thanks, Suresh.
When you come to Chennai, let's catch up for a dinner or something. It was really fun talking to you. Thank you.
Likewise, Suresh. Looks like you hobnob with movie stars and politicians. It'd be good to connect with me too.
That's a topic for another time. Okay, bye.
All right, take care. Bye.
Hi, folks. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share your thoughts and feedback to hello@sasboomi.com. You can access this and all other episodes of SaaS Boomi's podcast at www.sasboomi.com. SaaS Boomi is spelled as SaaSBoomi.com. SaaSBoomi.com. There is no H there. Until next time, this is Suresh signing off from you. Bye-bye.